Welcome to the National Civic Council's podcast, A Stronger Australia. The National Civic Council has advocated for the Australian people since its founding by Bob Santa Maria in the early 1940s. Today, it advocates for an economically and culturally strong Australia, which protects the vulnerable and supports the family as the cornerstone of society. During our podcast, we hear from a wide variety of speakers and experts on how to create a better Australia. We hope you enjoy. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of the NCC's podcast, A Stronger Australia. Today, we're joined by NCC President Patrick Byrne, who'll be sharing some insights into how Australia as a country can actually move forward, addressing the issues around COVID-19 and putting an end to lockdowns and border closures. A very exciting topic. Pat, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be with you, Beck.
So, Pat, I see that Newsweekly has just published a three-part series on the COVID-19 pandemic, focusing on failures and needs in public policy. So first off, we've only had 1,000 deaths from the virus in Australia, which is a lot better than other countries. So how deadly is the disease?
Well, firstly, as you said, we've only had 1,000 deaths, and that's largely because Australia has been very fortunate in being able to lock itself into Fortress Australia, close its borders, minimise the disease coming into the country. And it's done extensive lockdowns and interstate border closures. The problem we all know is, and everyone knows, is it can't continue indefinitely. You can't lock Australia down and stop it completely working indefinitely. So to get a picture, you really need to look at other countries like the United States. And to look at them, we don't look at case deaths. You know, that's a question there, whether people die from the disease or with it. Epidemiologists start by looking at what they call excess deaths. That is, how many people died over the period of the disease compared to people dying over the previous 3, 4, 5 years over the same periods. And up till about July this year, July, August, about 722,000 people have died in the United States. And then you have to look at what we call deaths avoided. And that is how many people would have died but for the vaccine. There are estimates of between 122,000, 175,000 people have had their lives saved. So when you add those together, you're looking at a death rate or potential death rate of around 1 million. Now, you can't get an absolutely accurate figure, but it gives you an idea of the order of magnitude of the disease. And I think the way people can best compare that is to say, well, how does that compare to the annual flu? And over the last 10 years, on average, the United States have had 36,000 deaths per year from the annual influenza. You were looking at a death rate of about 28 times the annual flu.
So speaking of infection rates, we're hearing a lot about the Delta strain. So overall, how infectious is COVID-19?
The Delta strain is different from the original Wuhan virus. The Wuhan virus was the original virus, and it spread, one person would spread to 2.7 others, and they'd spread to 2.7 others. The Delta strain is much more infectious. We don't know exactly how infectious. Somewhere one person can infect between 5 and 9 others, and so it then spreads out. And one study done of people with the Delta virus shows that their viral load in the nasal cavity is about 1,000 times the original Wuhan virus. So what we know is that it is highly infectious. It's just about as infectious as chickenpox used to be prior to vaccines for chickenpox. And virtually everyone got chickenpox. Virtually everyone got it as a kid.
Wow, so 1,000 times higher, that explains a lot about why it's spreading so much faster. So speaking of other diseases, is COVID-19 like influenza?
It's very different to the influenza. It's a COVID virus, and that is comparable. It is in the same species as the common cold. It is a vascular disease. It's not just a lung disease. It can affect many organs, including the lungs, but also the heart, blood vessels, kidneys, the brain. Most susceptible are those who smoke or are obese or have high blood pressure, diabetes, or other chronic illnesses. On the other hand, the Spanish influenza was an influenza virus, And it killed mainly younger people, whereas this one's killing older people by and large, but also people in their middle age, and particularly vulnerable back in 1918 were those with tuberculosis.
So we often hear it said that most people get over COVID-19. Is that actually the case?
Actually, most infected people have experienced mild or only moderate symptoms for about 2 weeks. But a significant number are what we call long haulers, or people with long COVID symptoms, people who were asymptomatic or had mild or severely debilitating symptoms that continue for more than 12 weeks and that can't be explained by other causes. Now, a very large study identified over 200 symptoms affecting 10 organ systems. And these include fatigue and loss of breath, heart inflammation, kidney damage, neurological problems, auto-nervous system problems, mental health issues, diabetes. Long haulers are becoming an ongoing major public health issue. In the UK, 89 specialist centres have been established. Now, to put it in a bit of perspective, particularly for younger people, The Atlantic magazine, which has some of the best commentary on COVID, has pointed out that there's a higher risk of 30-somethings being hospitalised and left with long-term illness than 60-somethings being infected and dying of COVID-19.
Right, okay. So can we turn to public policy to cope with the disease and end the lockdowns? What should the government actually be doing?
Well, first thing it should be doing is looking at quarantine. They should be setting up quarantine centres like at Howard Springs in the Northern Territory, large open places where they can house quite a number of people coming in from overseas, look after them there and keep them away from hotels where there's been far too many breaches of quarantine.
So let's turn to healthcare. How are our hospitals coping?
Our hospitals are strained in many states already from existing caseloads of other diseases. You have to understand that since the 1990s, most of the states, probably with the exception of New South Wales, has slashed both their health departments and have cut funding to hospitals in real terms. This has left the hospitals in most places in Australia short of intensive care nurses. To make it worse, in order to rebuild their health departments with the onset of COVID, they've recruited many people to work in contact tracing and testing, but they've come from the hospitals. So this has further depleted the hospitals of their capability to deal with a surge in COVID. People don't understand this because this is a major reason the governments have been resorting to border closures and lockdowns, and they won't be able to move from that very quickly, that sort of policy quickly, unless they get around 80% of the population vaccinated. Then when the risk is down, they can manage it. But the big issue is they need to restart rebuilding our health departments and putting more money into hospital care, particularly into ICU nursing.
So speaking of nurses, what about our healthcare workers? How are they coping?
Well, there's been studies done around the world of how healthcare workers are faring. And one in the UK earlier this year found that 45% of nurses were on the threshold of one or more of the following: post-traumatic stress disorder, severe anxiety, or drinking problems. Around 13% had suicidal thoughts. A Yale University study in the US found that 25% of all health workers were suffering comparable burnout symptoms to their British colleagues. So consequently, in many countries, nurses are leaving hospital work or the profession. I had a letter recently from a young friend of mine in the United States who works in a medium-sized hospital. Indicative of the problem nurses are facing is that from the beginning of August to the end of September, he said at the time, 20 nurses were leaving his hospital. And since then, more have announced that they're leaving either the hospital or the profession. So there's a real crisis going on with hospital care staff, which again is the reason why governments are now pushing hard for vaccinations in order to minimise the stress on the hospital system and on nursing.
So we hear of healthcare workers working in up to 6 different centres and as a result moving around spreading the virus. So what needs to be done here?
Well, this is another problem. We have seen nursing turn into casual and part-time work. And as a result, you'll have nurses working between up to 6 centres. What we need to do is to give more nurses full-time secure work. That then minimises the problem of nurses moving with the disease between centres and spreading it, particularly into aged care centres, where it's had a terrible and devastating effect.
So there's also been a lot of press coverage and debate around Australia getting enough supplies of the COVID-19 vaccine from overseas. So why have we been so dependent on other countries producing these vaccines?
In 1916, in the middle of World War I, the Australian government set up the Commonwealth Serum Laboratory, now known as CSL, to produce vaccines in times of crisis. CSL was privatised and sold off in 1994. Now the federal government is handing $1 billion to CSL to ramp up vaccine production facilities in Australia. It really shouldn't have been sold off, and the government really needs to be looking at setting up its own vaccine agency here in Australia.
So speaking of vaccines, how effective are they? And for how long will they provide immunity?
In the United States, 95 to 99% of the people currently being hospitalised and dying of COVID-19 are unvaccinated. I think that gives an indication of the effectiveness of the vaccine. Now, how long does it give immunity? Well, we don't really know. It's a COVID virus, like the common cold. And if you have a cold, immunity only lasts for about 3 months. I think I had three colds last year myself. So in addition, you may remember there was an earlier version of SARS-CoV, and that's called SARS-CoV-1 in 2003. It was far more deadly than SARS-CoV-19 today. They tracked around 178 people who recovered from that earlier version of COVID, and they found that immunity had waned and virtually disappeared in 2 to 3 years. To answer the question on how long to provide immunity, we don't know. We're going to have to wait and see.
How safe are these vaccines?
Look, they've been heavily tested, but all vaccines have a risk. For example, for shingles, there's very, very rare cases where people die of getting a vaccination for shingles, but that doesn't stop people getting their shingles vaccinations. With the AstraZeneca vaccine, at the time at which we'd have about 5.4 million shots in Australia, five people had died from the vaccine from blood clots. Now, to put that in perspective, a person has 50 times higher risk of dying in a car accident in Australia than dying from a blood clot from an AstraZeneca jab. But do people stop driving to avoid the risk of a fatal car accident or serious injury? So we're saying a wide range of vaccines should be made available to give people maximum choice. Some people may be wary of the risks.
What if someone actually does get COVID-19 despite all these various precautions? What kind of early treatments are available?
There's been much public controversy over preventative and early treatments. Governments should consult widely overseas with doctors and researchers experienced on COVID on the front lines on the possible preventative as well as early treatments.
What about vaccine passports?
We already have electronic COVID-19 digital certificates. They're automatically issued by Medicare to a person via their mygov.au website after a person's been vaccinated. This information is private and it's available to the person only and should remain private to that person. The right not to be vaccinated must be balanced against the right of others in the community to be safe and to receive necessary health care from hospitals. In short, one person's freedom not to vaccinate may lead to a seriously ill person being unable to receive appropriate care in hospital. So if a person who does not have a grave health issue chooses not to be vaccinated and puts others at risk, they will have to be prepared to accept limitations on accessing public events and spaces, as well as interstate and international travel.
What's the expected outcome here? Will community vaccination achieve herd immunity and get us all back to normal?
Well, herd immunity is when a population is high enough immune to block or slow the pathway for ongoing transmission of a disease. Now, governments are saying that if they can get 80% vaccinated in Australia, hopefully by November, they say, they can start easing restrictions. However, what percentage of the population we actually need for immunity from COVID-19 really is an open question, such as how infectious and deadly are new dominant variants like Delta? How effective are vaccines against these variants? The overall uptake of vaccines is important. How many people accept the vaccine? Levels of protection of the population then will vary over time with natural antibodies and vaccine strength, both of which may wane over time as they do just with the common cold. How evenly high levels of protection are maintained across the population? Because I'm sure we're going to have pockets of the population who are going to be susceptible for not being vaccinated. These variables make it impossible to predict the future with a great deal of certainty. Now, some countries have high vaccination rates, and we'll see in a few months how they go in opening up and how people can live. However, I'll give one warning at the end of this. Every time people think they've got on top of COVID-19 policy, it defies us yet again, and predictions and policies change. I just say to people over and over again, there are huge unknowns and many unknown unknowns.
Well, Pat, I think that's about all we have time for today. Let's hope that not only Australia, but the rest of the world is finally seeing the light at the end of the tunnel.
Thanks very much, Beck.
Make sure you subscribe to News Weekly to access ongoing coverage on this issue. Thanks for joining us, everyone, and we'll see you at the next episode of A Stronger Australia.
Thank you for listening to the National Civic Council's podcast, A Stronger Australia. The National Civic Council is a non-party political movement which seeks to build a strong and prosperous nation. Through our policy, research and advocacy, we stand up against the greatest threats to the family and the Australian way of life. The NCC also produces the fortnightly magazine News Weekly, which covers all topics relating to A Stronger Australia. Subscribe at ncc.org.au/newsweekly. We look forward to joining you for our next episode. Thank you for listening.